Hello everyone, and welcome to the Deathbed Adaptation Podcast, a bi-weekly book club where we choose one classic book and compare and contrast it against its cinematic adaptations. I'm your host, Nicolo Grasso, and I'm joined, as always, by the great Ewan Gledo. How are you doing, Ewan?
Good, I was putting down a bottle opener with extreme silent precision there. I was feeling good up until about 2 minutes ago when my second coffee of the day hit my internal organs, and now my heart feels like it's going to implode. I suppose that's a good thing, because that means the caffeine is in my system and on its way to my brain. So in about 20 minutes, we'll have some stunning commentary from me on a book and a film. But until then, I'm going to just be a sort of blob-like state of trying not to, you know. I feel like in about 5 minutes' time, I'll be clutching the desk, just hoping this wave of fear passes. But until then, I should be okay. I'm never full of fear. You know, you saw how much caffeine I drank in Venice. I was okay. There was a spider on my wall there. But yeah, not bad. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I had my coffee this morning. I haven't had anything since. I'm actually drinking some sweet chamomile tea because I want to balance out all the stress and all the work and just anxieties of living in the contemporary world, which is kind of fitting considering what we're talking about. Because 2 weeks ago we celebrated Halloween. Spooky time, spooky season with our good friend Carson Timar, talking about The Haunting of Hill House.
And then
It was 2 weeks ago, man. Yeah.
God, time flies when you're writing about murder, tits, and frogs for newsrooms. God. The big triple.
Heck yeah. But today we are back to talk about something far more depressing and we could even say scary than what we talked about last time. But of course, as always, before we continue, you're sitting there in your car, in your bed, on the toilet, in the gym, and you're listening to this podcast. You know, stop for a second and consider following us, leaving a like, thumbs up, subscribe, wherever you are, be it on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, doesn't matter. We welcome you all. We hope you enjoy this conversation and the ones that are soon to follow. So, without further ado, let's talk about Leaving Las Vegas.
Your gifts. Sarah. I love that name. S-E-R-A. Before we proceed onwards, there's something I have to say, okay?
Okay.
I've come this far. Here I am, in your house. I want you to let me pay this month's rent.
No.
All right?
Why?
Because it's better for me that way, okay? I'll tell you right now, I'm in love with you. But be that as it may, I am not here to force my twisted soul into your life.
I know that.
We both know I'm a drunk. And I know you're a hooker. I hope you understand that I'm a person who is totally at ease with this, which is not to say that I'm indifferent or I don't care. I do. It simply means I trust and accept your judgment.
I was really worried about how that would be, but no, I'm not. But you should know that included with the rent around here is a complimentary blowjob.
Yes.
Reading Las Vegas is a 1990 book written by John O'Brien. John O'Brien, whose personal life is very, very hard to figure out. There's not that much information. He wasn't a strong writer, per se. He was more of a teacher, you know, something like that. And he wrote this book in 1990. And at first, while it might just seem a fiction book, this is, unfortunately, sadly, shockingly, kind of a semi-autobiographical novel. The story of a man called Ben, who's an alcoholic, he's working in LA, just doesn't care about life, about anything, except for drinking. And he decides, you know what, LA, so many, you know, everyone wants to close down the shop and the bar, and they cannot get my drinks at like 7 a.m. in the morning or at 4 a.m. or at 1 p.m. Ah, it doesn't matter. I'm going to go to the place where bars are always open, where it's always night, where no one cares about what you do with yourself. And so he moves to Las Vegas, quits everything, decides, you know what, I'm just going to spend my last days in Las Vegas. And there he befriends a prostitute named Sarah, with an E, not an A. And they, you know, they form up this fascinating, intriguing friendship, bond with one another. But, you know, this is not going to last. Ewan,
hello.
What are your thoughts on the novel of Leaving Las Vegas?
I think it's very strong, I suppose. It's the entry point into it. Overall, it is very strong. And it's reading up on John O'Brien after reading it that the real sort of tragedy of it sets in, almost. I mean, the man wrote an episode of Rugrats, and that was his fate. He wrote
episode
34 or 37. Episode 37 of Rugrats was his, and he was horrified at the changes they made. But the lack of change in Leaving Las Vegas and sort of the presence of the characters is remarkable. It is stunningly character-driven, as he said, semi-autobiographical, and it, when you said it's the one place he goes to where all the bars are open, regards, I honestly thought you were going to say Sunderland, because Sunderland's a place you go and everywhere's got a bar open at some point. There used to be a bar called Seven, and I don't know if it's still there or not. It's been some time since it's been at Sunderland.
Okay.
But the whole thing about Seven was that it was open until 7 in the morning, and by that point, and you finished at 7, everywhere else starts open, so you can just sort of go around on a loop.
Get the nice Wetherspoons, you know?
Oh, Cooper Rose. One of the few Wetherspoons have a dance floor. Would not recommend it. Desperate memories from that time of my life.
I can't imagine how sticky it was to dance on that.
Oh god!
Just all the pure.
You would not get, like, once you were on that dance floor, you'd need to be lifted off of it. It's like you're just going to get stuck there. It's like cement. But as far as Leaving Las Vegas goes, it is a very intimate novel. A very horrifying novel as well. It's rather grim in the sense of, you know, O'Brien, what, he killed himself a few weeks after the book was sold for film rights.
They were about to go into production with that.
About to go into production, and he died of a self-inflicted gunshot, which is grim. But from reading Leaving Las Vegas and sort of knowing his mindset and that it's autobiographical, you shouldn't be surprised, because it is a horrible story, but it's told so intimately and so desperately well, and with sympathy, I think, is the most important part. There is sympathy for the characters, not just that he portrays, but are trying to portray him. And I think there's a very key difference between that. You know, I'm sure we'll get into that. I don't want to spoil too much. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to let people linger around for another hour, so we can't just give away all the details at once. But I will say that I think the differences and similarities between Ben and Sarah with an E are very, very distinct, in the sense that they both portray a side of him. But I do think one character is more inclined to showcase his personality than the other, and I don't think it's the obvious choice of the two.
Yeah. This book is dark. It might just be the darkest novel that we talked about. And, you know, we've explored quite a few horror narratives and, you know, intriguing thrillers and mysteries with gruesome elements. The Grinch, man, that spooky shit, you know. But Leaving Las Vegas is just, it's just so real.
Yeah.
It's uncomfortable. And one thing that I really appreciated, and I was not expecting of this book, is the way that it's structured. Because it's primarily just four chapters in this book. The first chapter, you're just following Sarah, going on her daily life as a prostitute in Las Vegas, encountering and meeting up with some very dangerous clientele, you could say. And then in the second chapter, you're just following Ben in LA, just going about his daily life and choosing to move to Las Vegas. And then after a brief interlude, the rest of the book is just one big chapter of the two of them together, meeting up and just, you know, finding this kinship, this connection. And I don't know how much of that element, you know, the character of Sarah, how much she actually existed in real life, if she even existed, if it's just, you could even say there are so many moments in this book where the character of Ben is just, you know, talking to her, almost treating her like this angelic figure. Like, where did you come from? It's like, are you just one of my hallucinations from one of my binge drinking sessions? But maybe actually he had someone like that. Maybe she was just, you know, alive in his thoughts, in his mind. But it's so touching. It's so moving. One thing that I particularly liked about this is how it keeps also going like back in time with just these small flashbacks that are put in parentheses, like, you know, opening them up, and it's like, okay, we're in the past now. Like, this is something that happened beforehand. It treats everything very seriously. It's incredibly mature. And I've like, reading the book, after knowing that the author killed himself only 5 years after publishing it and only a few weeks after selling the rights to make a movie, it's just like, man, this casts a different shadow over it. It reminded me of certain movies as well, like that feel like suicide notes of sorts. There was the one, An Elephant Sitting Still, something like that. It's a Chinese, maybe, but East Asian movie that's very long, very depressing, and just, man, and you find out, oh, the 30-year-old director was not alive after the movie was released because it was just like, you know, it was too much for him to end alive.
Is that the Hugh Ball movie? The really long one?
That's the one.
Yeah, I remember, I've been meaning to watch that for ages, but I think, just to touch on what you said there about the sort of the last hurrah for work, essentially, it's, you know, it's only in hindsight that we realise that that is the case for a lot of these, and it's, you know, quite terrifying that that is the case for a lot of art. I mean, even like you said, I mean, it's 5 years after Leaving Las Vegas was published, and it still feels like a final offering. And it's ominous. It really is quite scary, quite sort of, I think at some point, most artists sort of hit that crux where they're like, that's all I've got, that's all I've got to give. And some of them, I think there's a track record for artists just being sort of out of it, they're just completely wasted or gone from it, and that's it. They've got their art, and once they've finished that, what else is there? And it's quite grim, but it's captured quite well with John O'Brien's novel here. Terrifyingly so, and sadly so as well.
Yes, yes. It actually reminded me, I would call it, let's say, a blood cousin of sorts to Leaving Las Vegas. Leaving Las Vegas reminds me of a blood cousin to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Two very different desires.
So different. Both stories of, you know, addictions of sorts, of people slowly killing themselves. But one is, you know, darkly comic, played for laughs primarily. Very over the top, constantly moving, constantly going somewhere, episodic. It's just, it has a strong rhythm to it. And the other story, like Leaving Las Vegas, is very languidly paced. It's a lot of just, you know, these two people talking with one another and occasional interactions with other people outside of their sphere. But it's so calming in a way that feels like this is, I don't know the equivalent of, like, I love slow cinema, but this is kind of the writing equivalent of slow cinema.
Where it takes joy
and beauty in just the human normal moments of day-to-day life.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I suppose the difference, I'm glad you mentioned Fear and Loathing, because I didn't want to bring it up because I'm sort of the bloody Hunter S. Thompson mega fan.
Number one.
but I think the key difference is that Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is about the sort of the pursuit of the American dream, what makes people pursue it and why is it a fallacy. Leaving Las Vegas is just the death of the American dream. It's the gluttony of it, the aftershock, the effect of it.
Oh yeah.
And not to make a sort of a direct comparison, but it's rather telling that Vegas doesn't really change as a setting for either of those novels. It's still glitzy, it's still glamorous, there's still shows and parades and gambling. That the gluttony of Vegas is very much the key. And it's the solution that it provides, essentially. It provides a very big solution for John O'Brien's work, but it provides a different one for Hunter S. Thompson, where it's sort of a reactionary rather than an absolute. So with John O'Brien, you've got essentially that's the last stop before death. That's, you go there to drink yourself to death. On the other side of that, Hunter S. Thompson looked at it as, well, that is the place you go to drink yourself to death. But what happens if you come out the other end with something to show for it?
Yeah.
And the differences are quite stark, obviously. I mean, there is one, you know, leaving Las Vegas is very grim. It's very dark and it's very dingy. That is an atmosphere that is provided so well and so well adapted as well. But with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, there is a lighter tone to it. There's a fluidity to it. There is an articulation of something that shouldn't be articulate because it is under the influence of a lot of substances. And I think that's the great beauty of it. That's the great difference, is that one place can imagine so many different narratives. And, you know, you think about the stuff that's set in Vegas, you know, stuff like Casino, completely different shift in tone, but always about the gluttony that comes from that part of the world. And even in video games, you know, Fallout New Vegas, it's still the pioneer, it's the shining light of a community that has been ravaged by everything else. Gluttony will always prevail. And that's such a strong message to have, not just in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, or Leaving Las Vegas, or Fallout New Vegas, but it's just sort of a continual arc for that area, that setting, that premise. It's brilliant. It's such a deep atmosphere because it's still relevant. It's one of those things. It's kind of like the Beatles or Stephen King. It's one of those things that will always be relevant no matter what the genre or the time is. It's going to outlast us, obviously. It's going to outlast the people that were there. It's going to outlast the people that wrote about it. And it's quite chilling in a way. It's kind of like a villainous little creature, but something that doesn't really breathe.
It's the biblical Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just where lust and the excess reigns supreme. Everything is about sin. But even then, so many of these other stories almost portray it as a hellish landscape. Here it's more of a purgatory, a limbo, where just these souls are endlessly drifting and roaming around, just without aim. Everything is, like everything, like you said, mentioned, like the gluttony and the greed, like it's a self-eating world, pretty much. And it's disgusting and nauseating, but also refreshing to see it in this story from a normal person's perspective. It's not like a big impresario or the head of the mafia or whatever. So there's this strong level of humanity that is so emphasized with just the understandable self-destruction of both Ben and Sarah. Like, what do you think are the similarities between the two of them, and why do they connect with one another? Outside of some very good banter in their first interactions.
It'd be easy to say it's kind of just a run-of-the-mill kind of lost soul meets lost soul type of narrative, but I do think there is more to it than that. These are individuals that are essentially the byproduct of the Vegas atmosphere and aesthetic. They don't really have a choice. One of them has made the active choice to go there, but now they're stuck there. Like you said, that purgatory analogy is perfect. Where, you know, there is a sense of isolation to it. There is a sense of loneliness to both of them. And that is part of the narrative. But I do think a lot of it comes down to their sort of... Neither of them particularly care for sex. I think that is very, you know, important, especially considering Sarah is portrayed as a prostitute. She's essentially, in the book especially, treated quite horribly. In the film as well, quite horribly. But less so, and we'll get into that. But the key to it is that, you know, Ben has been saddled with drink. It's completely ruined for him. He doesn't care. You know, there's that scene where he just wants to talk to her and have a drink, and he's just clutching a bottle of tequila. And on the flip side of that, you've got someone that's been just sort of not interested in it because of the treatment that she has surrounding it. And the sort of intimacy there is not through their rejection of it, but because they've had that sort of experience, that lack of passion or care. And what comes through is sort of a desperation, a sort of need for human connection that transcends that of just, oh, they're lonely. It goes far beyond that. And I think it's really key to the narrative that it goes beyond that, because if it doesn't, it's just a generic sort of, oh, they're friends because they've got nobody else type of thing. And it John O'Brien does incredibly to avoid that. And it is really impressive that sort of the most intimate moments with them are not the usual run-of-the-mill Hollywood stuff where they're, you know, either having sex or being intimate and romantic. They're actually, it's more based on the philosophical arguments they present themselves and each other. And it does grow from there. It goes really strongly. And it actually feels like a relationship that matters as a friendship or as a platonic thing or even as a romantic thing, because it's never really quite sure of itself. It's never really, doesn't know where the line is drawn. I think that's the beautiful part of it. It's so unique. I can't think of anything like that I've seen before in like film or television. But it's just tremendous. It's kind of they would be in the same situation they would be in with or without meeting each other, but the fact that they have met each other makes it feel a bit more bearable for them. And I think that's really the key. It's about finding somebody that makes things bearable.
And also it's a shockingly, dare I say, respectful relationship between both of them. They're both aware of each other's situation, which is one of the changes we'll talk about with the movie. But in the book, Ben doesn't really know why he's doing what he's doing. He doesn't even say if he has a goal. He's just like, yeah, I'm just here. I just want to drink. I don't want to do anything else. This is all I want to do, just drink. And there's this understanding between the two of them that, you know, like, he knows she's a prostitute, but he doesn't really care. Like, it's a job. She's doing that. It's all right, baby. You know, no biggie. Meanwhile, she also respects the fact that, you know, oh, yeah, he's just drinking himself to death, like, constantly hungover. Not even hungover. He's just constantly drunk. It's impressive in that sense. It's just like, he's always on a high. Literally just drinking, never eating anything. He's just kind of carrying that throughout. There is so much respect, and it's so, again, I said mature earlier, but it really is. It's just an adult relationship. And it is fascinating how you were saying that, you know, is it romantic? Is it platonic? It is love. They say it as well. They admit it. They love each other. But they also never consummate it up until the very end. That is the only moment where there is any sexual interaction between the two of them, because otherwise it feels so genuine, it feels so passionate, which, again, like, did this happen? Maybe. Doesn't really matter. But it's so... What is the point of the story as a whole? Because, like you said, in a more conventional novel, which we've read them 1,000 times and we've seen 1,000 movies like this where... she ends up saving him. That's kind of the thing, you know? Like, she saves him and she stops being a prostitute and he cleans himself up because, you know what? I found someone who gets me. Someone who understands me in life. And I'm not going to go ahead with my prolonged departure from Earth. What do you think was the point of the ending where ultimately, like, this man is literally just slowly killing himself to death. She's incapable of doing anything, and she cannot do anything. He doesn't want her to do anything. And they share one final tender moment before he just, you know, passes away.
It's a sense of reality, you know? I mean, you know, not everybody can be saved that goes over that end. Not just in alcoholism, but just in general. There are people that will just refuse help. Mm-hmm. That's a given. And it's... what I always thought about the whole Ben and Sarah thing in this is that it's really grounded. You know, they are both products of the Vegas gluttony, and the end of it really is that, you know, I always think of people like, you know, Anthony Bourdain, for instance, who, you know,
that's a good one,
addiction. Mm-hmm. And there's always a breaking point. I remember reading, I think not the first book he did, Kitchen Confidential, but I think it was A Cook's Tale, where he wrote about where he was essentially just skidding around islands in a golf cart and nearly going over the edge, and it's, you've got to hit that edge to realize how far you've actually gone. Most of the time you will go over that edge, and that's it. That's permanent. That's a terminal condition that's gone. And that is essentially Ben. With Sarah, you've got someone that is close to that cliff edge. Ben's her cliff edge, essentially. She's seen what happens once you go over, and that's sort of the jolt to jump her back in. And in that way, it is quite positive. It's a sort of, not a happy ending, but a realistic ending of, this is an experience that will change someone's perception of how they live and how others feel about them. You don't have that for Ben. You don't have that sort of guiding light. Even if Sarah is there, that's not a guiding light. Someone that looks after someone is not somebody that can show them the cliff edge. And I think the real difference and the real stark thing to say about it really is that it sort of feels inevitable that Ben is going to end that way, because that is a man without any connection to anybody around him. And even if he has made connection, he's too far gone. There is a certain point where people hit that limit. They go on, and that's it. And it's very morbid. It's very real. It's very, very chilling. But the fact that he actually powered through with that as a message, as an actual structure for his story, is just so refreshing in sort of a bleak, sort of emotional tourist type way, where we're just... spectating. We're expecting something to change. We're expecting the turnaround. But the fact of the matter is, and there will be people listening, and there are people we don't do video, they won't be watching, but there'll be people listening that have had that experience. There'll be people speaking that have had that experience.
Yeah.
And they'll know that more than ever, that what John O'Brien is writing is particularly accurate. You can't be the cliff edge for someone that isn't interested. You've got to wait until they see it for themselves, or they'll go over. It's not a choice. And I think that's the key thing about Sarah's writing in this, is that she's for the book especially, a very independent character. The kind of have a perception of their own self-worth, but isn't actually realised until the very end. But that's where Ben comes into play. Now, for Ben as a character, he can't have that, because it just doesn't work the other way. Sometimes one person is good for another, but not the other way around. And that is tremendously well done. Like, it's so sincerely crafted, where it's even, you know, it's not like the perfect book. There are problems with it. But even in those sort of spottier moments, there is a real sense of these are real people. These are actually identifiable characters that can actually be extracted from that Vegas gluttony. And I know I'll keep saying Vegas gluttony because there isn't any better word or phrase to say it. But like you said,
it sends a message,
every narrative has that. I don't know why, but when I finished this, I thought about Time, the
interesting
Domhnall Gleeson movie.
Yeah.
And that's a perception of if you could alter the fabric of reality, you could have that perfect cliff edge. On the flip side of that, you can't do that. You can't time travel. You can't go in Coward and travel back to New Year's Day.
Just ain't real.
It just isn't real. And there is a reality that keeps these characters grounded. It keeps the narrative grounded. Because although, like, that's the thing. You might see a flicker of happiness. That doesn't immediately switch something in someone's mind and go, oh, I'll be all right then. Because I think especially with Ben, especially from what we see in the movie, he's been burned before, he'll be burned again. And that's sort of, that hope is diminished. That's gone. It's extinguished completely. And it's just, it's very accurate. It's very articulate. It's very, the fact that we have to sort of say this is very beyond convention, this isn't what we would usually expect, sort of shows a lack of understanding from movies and film and books on what actually happens with real relationships and real people, because that isn't obviously what we want to see on screen. We want to see the happy ending. We want to see the long goodbye. Mm-hmm. We want to see all sorts of good feelings to make us feel a bit more sufficient with ourselves, because otherwise we realize that we are living a bit like Ben and Sarah, regardless of whether or not we're drinking ourselves to death. But
John O'Brien's like, nope.
Yeah. John O'Brien essentially said, well, that's not particularly true, everybody, is it? And the actual truth of the matter is, you will slowly die, regardless of what you do, until you find that cliff edge. And it's so eye-opening in a way that, mainly because it's just not done much. It's never a focal point of a narrative piece anymore, that not every ending is a happy one. I can't think of the last film I watched where it was like a justifiably neutral ending. Because this is a neutral ending. This is kind of a, all right, well, one character is going to live on and hopefully learn from that, another character isn't. But there's not.
Do you think she's going to drop everything and,
well, that's the
reinvent
thing.
Herself? Or
that's the thing. You never know, but it's kind of the optimist in me, what little of it remains, kind of hopes so. But at the same time, that isn't guaranteed. And I think John O'Brien does well to keep it ambiguous with that. He keeps it ambiguous because who knows what she's going to do? There is no definite route. There's always the chance of a relapse. There's always the chance of going back into that behavior. There's always the chance of finding yourself in that situation again, but the real hopeful angle of it is that flame is still flickering, it's still on, and it's still available to one of the characters. Or on the other hand, it's just completely absent for Ben, for the whole thing. It doesn't feel inevitable, though. I think that's the key thing. O'Brien makes it feel like he has a chance. I think that's the absolute crucial part of Ben, is that he didn't feel doomed, not straight away.
Yeah. Yeah, it always plays with you. It always gives a little bit of hope that maybe it will change. But every time you think that Ben literally just says, like, you know what, this is not going to happen, just accept it right now. I'm not willing to change, just let me do what I'm doing, and we'll get on just splendidly. And that's what they do, and that's what happens.
Because people do that. That's how people
do
are.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just starts very organically. I like even that it's, there's no, you know, there's no, like, dramatic event that changed him forever. Just like there's no one specific thing that led Sarah down her path. In life, it's just a combination of things. It's smaller ones, bigger ones, and they all just converge together, leading to, you know, Ben's alcoholism, for instance. There is just one last thing I wanted to touch on that came to mind when you were talking about Sarah's character and her independence. She's independent, especially in the second half of the book, once she also frees herself from another character that we haven't mentioned yet, which I believe the name is Yuri. It is definitely Yuri in the movie.
In the movie, it's Yuri, yeah.
But basically, it's just her pimp. In the book, he's an Arab, I think like Middle Eastern, overweight man who pimped her out when she was in Los Angeles, and then he goes back to Vegas to find her, and he keeps pimping her out for a while until he's just delusional, scared out of his mind that, you know, people are listening to me and they're out to kill me. And he leaves. He just, you know, gives one last goodbye to Sarah and it's like, yeah, you know what, whatever, just I'm leaving, bye. And he leaves the city. What do you think is his place in this story? Because he almost seemed like someone, you know, to me at least, he almost seemed like one of those characters that is so despicable, because you also read about some flashbacks and some things that happened between him and Sarah in the past, you know, like how he's very abusive towards her in a very calculated way that's very upsetting to read about. But he almost seems aware of the corruptive nature of Las Vegas to the point that he might just be the only one who actually makes it out of the city in the book. He's just like, you know what, I'm leaving, this is not for me, and I need a fresh start as well. I need to do something more with my life. How do you see all of that?
I'm very glad you mentioned the fresh start there, because not to compare myself to a pimp, but I do feel that need for a fresh start. Obviously, you know I've been trying to move to Hull for that long.
Yeah.
And part of me is sort of, a lot of me with John O'Brien's work here is something that I never thought I'd connect with, because obviously, you know, it's about an alcoholic and a pimp and a prostitute. And I've not been any of those things.
Thankfully, not yet.
Brief flutters with all of them. No, so it's that that
we're all one step away, you know.
We are indeed. I mean, I remember uni. I used to drink, you know, every day, but that was, you know, that was manageable. That's the uni life.
It is.
As far as that free start, you know, that fresh start, that free spirit goes, it comes down to, it's an escapism, isn't it? It's, you know, Yuri is very much the shackles for Sarah. Once that's gone, that's a weight lifted. He's essentially the ballast for what she's trying to achieve, and life becomes a bit clearer when the ballast is sort of let loose, you know, when the anchor's sort of severed from a ship and they can just sort of move on. For Yuri to be that is acceptable. He does that as a supporting character. It's very strong and it's very articulated well for the first, I think he's only in the first half of the book really, isn't he, where he's kind of fled afterwards. As that as a role is really strong, but obviously, like you said, he does horrible things. Flashbacks are awful. And at the same time, there's a similar level of sympathy for Ben and Sarah that there is for Yuri, where it's, this is clearly a troubled person. He's got his own problems to deal with, which is why he essentially scarpers off into the night. Obviously, not as much sympathy for him because of his actions and what he finds himself doing, but he is in the same situation. Everybody that's in Vegas and stuck there is in the same situation. And it is that need for a fresh start. You know, people see a fresh start and they kind of cling to it. They get their nails in and they don't want to let go, which is, you know, I can relate to that on several levels. But as far as it goes as a narrative thing, it feels a bit what's the word for it? It doesn't feel like unbaked or like undercooked or anything. Yeah. It feels like it does its purpose. It does its job, but there's more to it than that. There must be something more that feels like it's just been left out. It feels like there's more to him as a character. Don't know why it's left out. We'll never know. But it works its purpose. It does well to sort of essentially set up Sarah as a free spirit for the second half of the book, where she's tied down but pushing against the tide, but then the tide sort of recedes and away she goes. That as a concept for Yuri's character is superb. And you get that. He's a greasy little slime ball and he's a horrible little guy. Obviously, The character in the book is very different to Julian Sands in the film. It
couldn't be more different.
Yeah, because when I think of fat, stout men, I think Julian Sands from Benedetta.
1995 recently. Especially.
1995 Julian Sands. The jawline that could cut steel. Yeah, he's, I mean, he's tremendous, tremendous choice, but it changes what Yuri stands for in the book to the film. In the book, he is the ballast for a character that needs to move on. And that kind of does feel like it's replaced with Ben. Ben's the next ballast. Ben is the person that's going to drag her back down to that gluttony of Vegas, that sort of lucid quality of living on the very edge of existence. And living like that is not appropriate, especially not if you need to take the next step. And I think part of that, part of Ben's death at the end of the book is a, sort of an acknowledgement that it is not safe to live like that, and it's not safe to live with people that are an influence of that. You know, you see Sarah get rid of one demon, only sort to be replacing it with another in the shape of Ben. Obviously, the treatment is better, the quality of conversation is better, the philosophy of it is better. The core of it, though, it is still toxic, and it's still very rudimentary, and it's still very dangerous. But it's a new danger, it's an exciting danger, because there is actual love and emotion and feeling and care there. It's harder to separate yourself from somebody that you actually care for than it is for somebody you don't particularly care for. That's obvious, but it's harder than it sounds for a lot of people. Especially for Sarah in this book, I think it's acknowledged really well. I think it's just well-rounded, and I think Yuri as a character is sort of the warning signs for what is to come, even if she does get along better with Ben, who, you know, for the sake of their relationship together, does treat her better, does seem a bit wiser to what she's gone through. But even then, there is still a manic depression to that stage of that relationship, and that's not going to pass, as we mentioned earlier, that sort of cliff edge type mentality. That's just Yuri, but with extra steps.
It's the ghost of Christmas future. It's just like...
Oh, God, you reminded me of that new Ryan Reynolds film coming out with Will Ferrell.
What? No.
They're doing a remake of Scrooged.
Oh, right, yeah. Is it, you like Apple Plus or something?
Apple Plus, yeah. You know me, my two favourite things in life, Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell.
What a combo together at last.
You could put me in a room with Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell, or you could put me in a room with, like, I don't know, one of the saw traps, and I know which one I'd be picking. Ryan Reynolds and Will Ferrell, not an animal.
Anything's better than...
I would be very upset, is what I'm trying to say. You know, oh, look, it's the guy that did Anchorman and nothing else, and oh, look, it's the guy that's done nothing but buy a football club. Wonderful.
Ouch. Ouch.
Sorry, no. Was he in The Proposal?
Ryan Reynolds? Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey. My knowledge of rom-coms has receded somewhat, much like my hairline. I'm joking. I've got a lovely head of hair. Sorry to make
everyone listeners
jealous,
don't know, yeah.
My hair is fantastic. I know there's no video for this podcast, but the absolute legions of hair that I've got and will be remaining on my head is stunning.
If you want to see Ewan's hair, you have to. You can go to the Don't Listen to This podcast YouTube page.
Yeah,
we see it in its entire wonderful glory.
The issue with that, though, is that my hair now is very different how it is on there, and I record the episodes that far in advance that I've had a haircut since then that looks a bit more better. But
I don't give it time.
If you wait
give
around for a couple months, you'll get new hair, Ewan, and that's kind of like the same as old Ewan, but a little more cocky and a little less verified on Twitter. What's the point in being verified now that anybody can do it? I'm not special anymore, so I've got to go to, like,
up.
What the hell am I meant to use now? What can I get verified on?
Letterboxd? You can ask Daily Star.
No. They want me to I'm celebrating my birthday in November.
Yeah.
For an exclusive. So I'm buying a party hat and I'm heading off out into town to celebrate my birthday a month before. Because I'm born on Christmas Day, so it's like a kind of... Oh, well, I'll
it's hard to celebrate it on the day.
Celebrate it on November 25th to beat that Jesus fella from stealing the spotlight and stuff. Yeah.
Classic Jesus.
What's he like?
But speaking of, like, after this novel came out, it was a moderate success. I do believe if John O'Brien compromised some of the darkest elements, it kind of made it more uplifting, you know, damn it. It would have been a bigger success, but also it would have completely been lost to time and space, just like this diluted version of the novel would not work. But the rights were bought in 1995. As we said, unfortunately, he killed himself, the writer John O'Brien, but the man who was tasked with directing this book, Mike Figgis, soldiered on. I was like, you know what, I'm tempted to stop here because it's just uncomfortable to keep on making a movie after this happened. But in the same way, let's try to celebrate this man. Let's bring this story to life, especially since it was very personal to him. Again, it was the only novel of his that was published while alive. There are a couple of posthumous novels that have been published over the years. And now we have this 1995 Oscar-nominated and winning film starring Nicolas Cage, Elizabeth Shue, and Julian Sands. Of course, Nicolas Cage won. It's just, it's like I have a potato in my mouth every time I speak. And Nicolas Cage won the Oscar for this performance, the only Academy Award that would change his career, going from more arthouse oriented movies into massive action blockbusters. But this is seen by many still to this day his finest performance, or definitely one of his finest turns. The same for Elizabeth Shue, who was nominated. And yeah, the film has garnered, let's say, a cult status because of these Oscar nominations, but also for the darkness that was present in the novel and that was kept for almost its entirety intact in the movie. Ewan, what are your thoughts on this film?
This is one of the, you know, I've had Letterboxd a while. I think it's one of the, I think about 60-odd films that I've got on a 5-star. I adore this film. I think it's incredible. I think it's so perverse and disgusting and drab and upsetting and uncomfortable. It's just perfect. It understands the novel perfectly. It's like filth, but for Las Vegas. It's filth, the book, not just filth in general. Filth as in like the Irvin Welsh book.
Which we did talk about.
Mike Figgis, though, the director, is actually a patron of the independent cinema near me, Tyneside Cinema. He's the patron there. One of them alongside, I think Ken Loach was for a time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, lovely guy. But his work understands what the book is about. And I think it's rare that you can say that a director who's adapting a work that is not his own, that the author has passed, it's rare you can say that they understand it fully. And I do think it's the little intricacies that make me think Mike Figgis really understands what Fear and Loathing. I've done it again.
Just what mixing them up.
Las Vegas is about. He knows what it's about because I feel as if he's understood what O'Brien was trying to get through. I really do. And it's, you know, you mentioned there Nicolas Cage, his only Oscar-winning performance. I do think it's his best performance as well. I really do. I don't think it gets better than this for him. And like you said, it was. A shot in the dark for him, but it's you know, 2 years later he was doing Face Off, which is arguably one of the best action films ever made. I'm not even saying that with any hint of irony, it just is.
Oh yeah, baby.
And you sort of look at the state of his career now. Obviously he went through that, people say it's a rough patch, but you look at something like Leaving Las Vegas, and then you look at something like, I don't know, Prisoners of the Ghostland, Color Out of Space, Mandy. It's the exact same performance, it's the exact same style. Just, it depends on how it's adapted. That Cage zaniness is right there, and I know people love it, and Leaving Las Vegas knows exactly what to do with it, because to show him as this kind of not ambitious person, but as a larger than life character, which is essentially what drink does to people, it makes them confident, it makes them shake, and to use that as an energy, as something that provides Cage with a bit of a new layer for his sort of the same thing he does in Ghost Rider or Face Off. It just utilizes him so well. It's perfect. It is truly wonderful to see that sort of, you know, he's in the bank and he's like shaking, and then he comes back in later and he's like sophisticated and calm, but he's still like larger than life.
He needs the alcohol to put a signature down on a piece of paper.
Precisely, yeah. He needs the alcohol to stop his hands from shaking, but that is just a raw Cage energy that is just adapted so well. I can't articulate how much I love it. There's a scene where, I think this scene in particular sums up perfectly why I absolutely love Leaving Las Vegas as an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
It's where he sat on the bus bench and there's two nuns in the background giving out pamphlets of salvation. And it's just an articulate understanding of, and I think that's where it, you know, Figgis understands the book. He's always close to that salvation. He'll never reach it though, because nobody in that state does. And I think there's just an understanding of that really truthfully throughout. And it never fades. It's never hinting at a happy ending. It's never trying to think, well, he might make it out, because you've just seen a man down an entire bottle of bourbon. He's not coming back from that. That is a new level. And I can't think of any films that have shown that desperation so prominently, so ominously, so really. I mean, you know, again, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, that was more focused on the camera work, the technical merits that bring sort of drug abuse to life. But
Very Terry Gilliam style. Very colorful and kaleidoscopic.
A lot of Dutch camera angles, all the usual stuff. Beautiful. You never get a film, and I mean, I remember when I wrote about this for Clapper all those years ago about Another Round and sort of the inclusion of alcohol on screen, how it works. And I did a video essay on it. It's the only one I've ever done. I enjoyed doing it. It's the only one I've ever done. It's the only one that's ever gained me any traction. And Hollywood has a real issue around displaying drinking problems and displaying alcoholism. You know, you get something like Flight or Barfly. Or there was another Billy Wilder film from the 40s that I can't remember the name of, but they essentially show
The Long Weekend.
The Long Weekend.
Or Lost Weekend.
Lost Weekend, yes. They all show alcoholism as sort of a brief hurdle to mount. It's something that you can just sort of go through very briefly, very quickly, for the sake of a narrative crutch. And it's not that. It clearly isn't. Anybody that has been through it at some point will tell you, no, it's not that. Actually, it's very, very different. And I think Leaving Las Vegas shows that best. It summarizes what happens at the deep end of that spectrum, which I can't think of anywhere that's done it before. Another Round did the other end of that spectrum, where it's very light. They've dabbled with it, they've sort of touched upon it, and they've realized the consequences of it. Leaving Las Vegas at the other end of the spectrum, it's they haven't realized the consequences of their actions or what they're doing. They don't really care either, and that is the end result. I think it's just such an articulate understanding of the novel, not just from its premise and its meaning, but also its actual events, its stages, and its lifespan. It's perfect. It is the perfect adaptation. I don't think it gets any better than that, other than like Filth. I think maybe that's just ahead of it because of its lighter tone with the darker symmetries.
But more cinematic in that sense.
Yes. Leaving Las Vegas is a purely adaptive novelization. Taking a novel and putting it on the screen, it doesn't get better than that. That's perfect.
Wow, high praise. Probably the highest praise since Filth, actually.
I mean, I'll put it this way. It's better than The Godfather. There we go.
Woo. Okay.
That'll anger the middle Americans in their mid-60s shaking their walking sticks.
Oh, boy. I'm not taking that bait. But Living Las Vegas. I watched Living Las Vegas in 2018. I was doing a Cage-a-thon. Just kind of going through all the Nick Cage movies I hadn't seen, all the big ones. I was like, I love this guy. Why haven't I watched all these classics? Let's just get this done. And then Living Las Vegas, I saved as one of the last movies to watch because I loved him so much. You know, it's the Oscar-winning performance. It's amazing. I was like, okay, I'm going to save that. I'm going to savor it. Enjoy it to the fullest. You know, little cherry on top after this 40-movie marathon. And then I watched it, and I didn't like it. I was like, I'm bored out of my mind. This is uneven. This is dull, uninteresting. Sure, he's great, but I also like Elizabeth Shue more. You know, I was just left incredibly cold by it. Cut to yesterday, when I rewatched it after having read the book. And it was a completely different experience. I don't necessarily love the movie, but I like it quite a lot, and I respect it so much. It just clicked this time around. Like you said, Mike Figgis gets it. He understands what John O'Brien went through. He understands the core of the novel. And he adds a couple minor touches that I think improve certain elements of it. For instance, he removes the ambiguity of what Ben is trying to do. Because in the book, he's just kind of like, I don't know, I'm just here drinking, whatever. In this book, he literally just says, oh, I'm here drinking myself to death. Like, that's what I want to do. Come to Las Vegas because I want to die. It's very blunt. It's very straightforward. But it's one of very few subtle differences that kind of changes so many aspects of the story in the way that it's framed. And speaking of framing, just the way this is put together, I forgot just how soft the jazz soundtrack is. It's so, like, you know, this lounge type of music, very romantic in a melancholic way, very peaceful as well. it's a quiet movie. This does border on slow cinema in certain elements. You know, it's very happy, staying in this languid pace where very few things happen. Shot with 16mm cameras to kind of give it that grittier feel. That also kind of highlights the surreal nature of Las Vegas. I really, really like this time around. I do genuinely agree now that, yes, no, this is one of the best Nick Cage performances, well worthy of a top 10 at least. But to me, like, I loved her the first time around. I loved her even more here now. I think Elizabeth Shue is phenomenal in this film. This is one of the... I'm not a performance type of guy, but this is one of the best performances of the 90s. Once again, this is just a recurring theme now on both this podcast and the Uncut Gems podcast of just, you know, like, absolutely perfect performances by female actors who are then absolutely, you know, just shunned by Hollywood, like they never will have a role as good as this. And Elizabeth Shue kind of, I don't want to say she went into, you know, nothingness, but she ended up playing a lot of moms in movies. I think she's the mom in Death Wish who dies. I think the closest to a great performance and interesting character by her was on The Boys, the first season of The Boys. I don't know if you've seen it. She's very great in that one. A very villainous role, very refreshing. I was like, oh yeah, Elizabeth Shue, woo, she's back. But yeah, I think there are so many beautiful moments, and what I appreciated the most is how much it sticks to the source material, especially with the dialogue. There are so many instances where I was like, this is the book, like verbatim. This is a scene from the book. What a film. What a film. Actually, just talking about it already, it's growing on me. What do you think are the most interesting differences from the book? What do you think even is that different from the book, outside of, you know, like Yuri, like, or at least the pimp now, is like Eastern European, maybe just Russian, downright Russian man.
They say he's Latvian.
Latvian, there you go. Yeah.
I think the key difference for sort of the book and the film is the change in perspective and the change in focus. Obviously, you've got that big opening chapter with Sarah, which really sets the scene in the book. I get why it was cut from the film. They don't really have time to do it, which is a shame because it's probably the most interesting part, and it's really important that you get the behind-the-scenes action of
it's
that.
It's a great start, yeah.
Elizabeth Shue would have been an absolute masterclass in that because, like you said, she is phenomenal. That run she had from the mid to late 90s with, like, you know, she had Leaving Las Vegas, she had Deconstructing Harry, she was in Hollow Man.
Oh, you're right, yes. Yeah. Oh, no, we did talk about her in Hollow Man.
We did.
On Uncut Gems, yeah.
A phenomenal performer that, again, like you said, crops up occasionally and is kind of, oh, yeah, I remember them when they did that good film. It's like she was in Greyhound, that Tom Hanks film, a couple of years ago. But that's her last recorded credit on Letterboxd, which is about as accurate as you get these days, to be fair. But before that, it's like Battle of the Sexes, that tennis film 3 years before. So maybe it's just a change of pace for her, I don't know, but it's a shame because she was an extreme talent, and it's a shame as well that they don't let them adapt Sarah's full story to Leaving Las Vegas, because I know she would have done a terrific job. She does a terrific job of what she's left with here. It's a very articulate and dedicated performance that, at the same time as holding its own, like all good main roles, make sure it has cohesion with the other main roles. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not trying to outshine Nicolas Cage, but neither is Nicolas Cage trying to outshine Elizabeth Shue. There's a real sort of chemistry there. There is a real chemistry, and it really does allow itself to open the broader parts of Leaving Las Vegas, which are touched on so well by O'Brien. And most of it comes down to the fact that they both have really good chemistry. There is a real dynamic on screen. There's a real care. And then individually as well, like in standalone, you've got Cage running rampant on alcohol, sort of taunting bartenders and, you know, being a generally disorderly drunk. But then you've got Sarah, who has a nice scene with Ali Ermey at the casino bar, and it sort of gives the inferences away and it gives sort of her gambit away. It's just really, really well done. But obviously, a bit more focus on Elizabeth Shue would have been superb. But obviously, it's kind of hard to fit that in. I understand it can't be sort of shown. It is shown briefly in those like little interactions by herself when she's like trying to talk to potential customers or sort of saying what they can and can't do to her. That sort of thing is there, and it's as lacking in emotion as it should be, mm-hmm. because it is in the book. And it's really well adapted. I just wish there was more of it, but that's me being gluttonous.
In a way, I'm kind of happy those moments are cut, because this film has some sort of, like, we could even say, like, lyrical beauty to the way that it's put together. Meanwhile, John O'Brien's book has moments of peacefulness, but it's so realistic and it's so unapologetically just gross sometimes. Yeah. All the scenes, like you mentioned, the first part with Elizabeth Shue, well, with Sarah, sorry, it's so nasty, and it goes into, you know, graphic detail of the encounters that she has with her clients, with her Johns, but I think maybe they would have not have fit in the movie. I think even the fact that she, I don't know, maybe something in contracts, like no nudity or close to it pretty much with her, I think it makes her even more of a, it makes it easier to respect the character. I think it would have been very easy to verge into exploitation if they had these scenes, because the only moment where we actually see her with a client is when they move around the gangbang from the first chapter. They kind of move it at the end of the film, which I was like, oh my god, I forgot it was actually at the end of the movie. And it's upsetting, it's disturbing as hell, very uncomfortable, and still edited and put together with enough, you know, care never to verge into, again, exploitation. It's just really well put together. I was like, my thing is, why haven't I watched anything else from him? That's something I was like, why haven't I seen more from him?
His name always feels like a name that sort of crops up with one great idea and then just kind of dissipates after that. He did Stormy Monday, which is set in Newcastle. It's a rom-com thriller with, it's like comedy, dramatic romance thriller, whatever they are. It's just such an amalgamation of genres. But anyway, Tommy Lee Jones is in it.
Oh my.
And Sean Bean and Melanie Griffith and Sting. So it's not good, but it's one of the few films set in Newcastle, so it kind of has a soft spot in a lot of people's hearts up here. But it's like Mike Figgis' name sort of crops up. It's like, oh, do you remember Mike Figgis? Yeah, I do. He's not somebody that sort of had a presence as a household name. Not everybody does. There's a lot of directors that don't, but it's rather, he does have other films, you know. It's as mad as that sounds. He does have, like, other decent films. He did Internal Affairs, he did Mr. Jones, he did Time Code. But the most recent thing he did was, Suspension of Disbelief, which doesn't look good. Someone has called it an homage to Godard, so I will not be watching
that. Oh, that sounds like my kind of movie.
2.5 out of 5 on IMDb from 135 ratings.
Oh, that's not...
Sebastian Cox in it, from Bridge of Spies and The Lives of Others, and Never Look Away. Okay. So he's in it.
Interesting.
And, as far, you know, Internal Affairs is the, you know, Richard Gere film. Elijah Wood's in it. The detective one in Los Angeles that was probably overshadowed somewhat by the actual release of LA Confidential, the book. But we all make mistakes, Mike, don't we? Anyway, he's one of those names that should be kind of a household name, because he has directed big films. He worked with big film stars, essentially. He worked with Richard Gere, Nicolas Cage, Elizabeth Shue. He worked with the big names, but was never quite there. He was never the next level, which is a shame, because his direction is superb. Like, camera work, the quality, and the filming itself is stunning. It's just incredible.
It's so well thought out. He even made the main theme. Like, he's a composer in his own right. I was like, holy shit, it's him.
It's like the binary opposites that are just present on that screen. Beautiful. You know, the disarray of drinking someone to death in Las Vegas while some really nice jazz melodies play over the top of it. It's just such a nice callback to that sort of aesthetic, really, like the Billy Wilder Lost Weekend film of, you know, these are not really taken seriously type of thing. This is not a narrative that is taken seriously in the 40s or the 50s, because it's like, oh, well, he just drinks too much, that's okay. By the 90s, you've got, you know, the same music and sort of the realization that it's not okay to sort of drink that much, you know. I just to go back to that Nicolas Cage energy before forgetting, it's just what I've remembered. It's the film when he's in the supermarket and he's shopping and he's dancing around. That's just Nicolas Cage, but it's framed correctly. It's articulated right. the direction is perfect for that scene. It doesn't do anything to change Cage. It's how Figgis adapts to Cage. And I think that's the big thing for Nicolas Cage, especially now. You know, he's had this resurgence. People have realised what makes his acting work. Mm-hmm. They've realised the key to unlocking it. It's not that he's not a versatile actor. He just plays a lot of roles quite similarly. You know, you've got something like The Wicker Man, something like Willy's Wonderland, and then something like Leaving Las Vegas. The similarities between his performances are kind of there. It's got that massive energy to it. It's got that broad appeal. It has the intricacies needed to change performance on a whim, where it's like, you know, alcoholic in Las Vegas, silent protagonist in Willy's Wonderland. At the core of it's a strange choice. But at the core of it is an understanding that Cage is what sells it. Cage's presence and Cage...
He's committed every time. Brings.
He's such a committed actor. And I think that's why like the Cage dives that you did are just superb, because regardless of the quality of the movie around him, he is consistently doing what he does best. It is up to a director to understand what he's doing and how he does it and how that will best suit their film. With Leaving Las Vegas, he realizes, you know, this energy is something that an alcoholic could bring. This is something that somebody at the will of the end of their life, that's someone at the end of their rope, the end of their tether, that's it. That's what they'd be acting like, because they've got no sort of connection to the real world around them. They don't care. I think Cage brings that out so well, but obviously to do that, you have to have a good director like Mike Figgis, who is incredible, superb.
There's so many moments that could have been memeable, like,
yes,
people like to do and love to do with Nicolas Cage. But I love this one review on Letterboxd that I was reading of someone just, you know, they went to a Nick Cage-a-thon in the cinema, and every movie was always like people laughing, coming for the memes. It was very annoying. But then when they went to watch Leaving Las Vegas, all the dude bros, like after 20 minutes, the laughter just started to die down. And they just left shocked and depressed, because it is such a depressing watch. Yeah. Because it feels so, again, they're so raw, the performances. Hats off to Cage for actually, you know, researching, you could say, the role by going on binge drinks himself and recording himself while drunk. And it comes off as realistic. It's none of the, oh, this lord's speech, I want to drink too much. It's like, no. It's like, if you drink, I mean, some people, but most people I notice, if they drink a lot, they're still, you know, they know what they're talking about, they know what they're saying.
Yeah.
If they black out, it's something else. If they go way too far on the deep end, it's something else entirely. But it also, something that I've always said and thought is that, you know, when someone drinks a lot, their true colors kind of shine through, and whoever they really are is just emphasized. And there is something to be said for how just kind of honest and very quiet he is when he's drunk in this movie. Even in the book, like, the character itself is just so, you know, it's so likable in its own weird way, which also kind of ties with all of the opening stuff with him losing his job, where they fire him, where they literally just go like, you know, we like having you around, it's a shame. Even in the book, he knows this is coming. I was like, I'm actually shocked they let me stay drunk on the job, just basically working for 60 minutes every day instead of like 7 hours or 8 hours, because they just like having him around, you know. He's a good drunk. But yes. It's a great film. It's very depressing. But just the final thing I wanted to ask you, unless you have other questions as well, just the ending. How do you feel the ending is the same as the book? Because it pretty much is. But do you think this one leaves it with a little bit more hope for the future, or not? Because there is one, because the major difference between the two is that in the book, Elizabeth Shue as Sarah, she just, you know, goes to the window and looks outside, like, he's in the bed, he's shivering. She just gave him a handjob, I believe. I was like, you know, just living in there, just like, this is not happening until it's too late. She hears quiet and she knows, like, he's dead. But in the film, they actually have intercourse together, and it's the kind of, it's very tender, romantic. It's the only moment they have any type of sexual interaction with each other. How do you feel? And then she just, you know, he's dead and she's ready to leave the room pretty much. And she has a beautiful final line. How do you feel the two endings differ from each other? Do you think they leave you with something different? Are they essentially just the same thing, just executed in a different manner?
I think it's one of those rare occasions where they both work for me. Mm-hmm. The book is particularly open and very broad, and it's not optimistic in the usual sense. It is optimistic in the sense of anything is now possible. She's looking out that window, she's looking at what lies beyond, and what is beyond is who knows. And I do like that as a narrative choice, to have it open-ended, because it feels rewarding, it feels deserved for John O'Brien to write that, because who knows what happens next. It's that cliff edge again. She doesn't know where she's at yet. For the film, I understand that it needs to be a bit more close, because it's the brutality that precedes it does warrant a bit of a happier ending, especially visualizing something and reading something of two very different states of mind for art. And to show instead of tell is very different. And I think Figgis is kind of like, you know, all right, we've had everybody through the ringer for the hour and 40. Let's calm it down a bit. And I think that's where the feeling of about time came through for me. It's that sort of, you know, even if people don't display it, or if they don't display it for too long, there is real feeling and connection. And I think the final scenes where she's like the therapist saying, oh, he did love you and all that stuff, it doesn't need saying. I think it's obvious, but It's nice sometimes to have that confirmation. It's nice to know that there is value. And sometimes films kind of go a bit hard into that. I think it's something like Love, Rosie, or like a typical rom-com. I know it's not an active comparison to compare a light rom-com. About that. Exactly. I forgot about it until it flashed in my mind. I watched it once in uni, and that was it. But it's, you know, it's not fair too much to compare a rom-com to this. However, it does have articulate tropes, and it does have that feeling of, you know, an endless sort of love that is showcased very clearly at the end to make up for the violence and the brutality that Elizabeth Shue's Sarah goes through. To the point where I think it's justified to have that sort of less than open-ended feeling, because the result is still the same. The result is still very much in the palm of Sarah. It's up to her to sort of shape that future, to shape what she does next. And I think that is the most important part of either O'Brien's work and Figgis's adaptation, is that Sarah is shown to be now an independent person with the chance to create something. And I think both of them do it well, but differently. Mm-hmm. I think one of them is more optimistic than the other, because one of them is giving the assurance that it is something that she understands. She does understand that Ben's love is there. On the flip side of that, I do like this. I mean, I'm kind of a, you know, desperately pessimistic person. And do kind of like the lack of break from reality. You know, it might not be okay. She might not have had the same feelings to Ben. She might have taken pity on him. Ben might have just been using her as a crux for his alcoholism. We don't know that, and it's so open-ended. I think Figgis essentially just draws a conclusion that everybody was going to come to begin with. I think it's fine. I think I probably would have come to that conclusion if it had been open-ended. I would have thought, yeah, she's probably going to do that. Yeah, fine. Because it feels justified. It feels like it's valued, and it feels like Sarah is then valued by the end of it, which is the most important thing. Really, this is a film about Sarah. And As much as the film shies away from the more gruesome moments, even if that last stage does come through with the students, which is just brutally horrible, there is still an articulate understanding of why Sarah's character is so important, why that growth is so important. It's the cliff edge mentality. And
it's one of the rare times the Academy got it right. She's listed as leading role, not as a supporting actress. She's like,
and I think the bulk of, sorry, I just cracked my arm if that came on the microphone. Oh wow,
that was loud. Oh,
did that pick up on the microphone?
Yes.
Oh wonderful. Right, not about that. I'll try and crack the other one. Hang on.
Oh, wow.
That one. Yeah, there we go. Oh,
feeling better.
Sweet release. No, but overall, it's kind of, you know, Sarah's ending either way is justified. And it's rare that I can say a book and a film, despite having different endings, come to the same conclusion. I think it speaks more for the open-ended work of O'Brien than it does for Figgis's adaptation. But at the same time, Figgis adapts something that I really do hope and believe that O'Brien thought that as well. I really do hope. But, you know, if he thought so, he would have written it. So I don't know.
Yeah. Hats off to Mike Figgis for staying true to the source material. It could have been so easy to make compromises and changing things up for the worst.
The pressure that Figgis must have had to just change this into and they were both happy and fine at the end type thing, because that was pretty popular at the time, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Woody Allen was still making movies. I think Bullets Over Broadway, The Deconstructing Harry was out at the time, and he was still making money in the box office and stuff, you know. As if the light rom-com in the dark days was over. You know, you think of something like Trees Lounge the year later from Steve Buscemi, the sort of alcoholic as a hero rather than as a... Mm-hmm. as a supplement for disease. It's really quite remarkable that Figgis managed to avoid it. But what did you think? What do you think of Figgis' ending?
I like it. I almost like it more than the novel, because it's like you said, one's more pessimistic than the other. It's all about the central relationship, what was really there. But yeah, I kind of like that it's the more, you know, the more conventional choice that Figgis makes, but it's also one that feels earned. It doesn't feel hokey, it doesn't feel forced in any way. It's so earnest and so heartbreaking. Especially the fact that we've seen Elizabeth Shue go to the psychiatrist, maybe not. Like, there's a lot of like close-ups of her face just talking to someone, and it feels like she's opening up to the psychiatrist, or maybe to someone else, who knows. But the fact that the movie, the final shot, is the same thing. It's her face after he's passed away, and she's just sitting on the bed, kind of, you know, rethinking about their love, which, again, it could be interpreted in many ways, this love, but it was love nonetheless. You know, it got to me. It got to my cold, cold heart. I was like, oh my God. Yeah. I was just thinking, how did I dislike this movie the first time around? Like, how, you know, in 4 years, so many things change, you know. I did go to the UK and discovered what true drinking really is, so you know, maybe that helps as well.
I think that's the thing. I don't think this film would have connected with me so much had I not sort of not, you know, I didn't go in the deep end of drinking, but it was kind of
you know what that, feels like.
You have that uni experience, you have that sort of you got to drink every day type feeling. It's terrifying in hindsight, but at the time it's quite fun. But actually reflecting on it and having a piece of art that can reflect on that is really rare, because I mean, like I've written about before, there are very few pieces of film or literature that actually reflect on it correctly. I think the only other thing I can think of is Another Round. I think that does it very articulately and very well in limited doses. Leaving Las Vegas just kind of thinks, oh well, it should go full throttle, let's fire through, and it's brilliant, it's unbelievable.
That's one hell of a triple feature, man.
Oh,
Leaving Las Vegas, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and Another Round. And they're gonna come out of it maybe becoming an alcoholic, drug addict, or someone who will be sober for the rest of their life.
I think if you showed this to anybody, like if I watched all three of those back to back, I would no doubt, I mean, I could go teetotal, but where's the fun in that sort of thing? It's like, I would never touch drink again, but then having said that, I've got two Jaeger bombs by me, and I know I could just plow through those immediately.
Don't look at them.
I live life on the cusp. You know how drunk I was for that Tilda Swinton premiere. I fell asleep.
Eternal Daughter. Oh my God.
That was a great review of a film I vaguely remember.
The way it was meant to be seen. You know.
The way it was meant to be seen. Six vodka cokes deep on a Tuesday afternoon in the blistering heat.
In a bit of an empty stomach. Oh man, memories. Well, I've got good times, man. I have one last question for you. Ultimately, after this conversation, which is best for you? The book or the film of Leaving Las Vegas?
Book or the film? It's a tough one, isn't it? Because essentially they are more or less the same piece, but one of them is doing the visual upheaval for you.
Yeah.
I think based on sort of what Figgis manages to do and what his characters manage to do, particularly Elizabeth Shue and Nicolas Cage. Also, we didn't touch on Julian Sands mainly because he's just kind of there briefly. He's
not, yeah, I still think it's a bit of a throwaway character, his presence. He's the pimp. He gets killed by mob. Yeah. There's like this implication that you see this armed man that Nicolas Cage finds on the road, and then we see them again entering his hotel room as Sarah, Elizabeth Shue, is leaving him for the last time. He just tells her, like, oh, go away. He seems very paranoid, like in the book, but it's... I want to say that's probably the only element that's still undercooked. It wasn't already that great to begin with. like the whole character in the book, the pimp.
Yeah, he's...
But in the film, he's even more... You need him there, but also...
Best of a bad situation, I suppose, isn't it? I think the film is better than the book. I'm going to go with the film, mainly because it's a few extra components that the book can't deal with. You know, it's the... Adapting a character like that as a broad stroke is difficult. And I think managing to articulate it that well is incredible. And not just that, but the character of Sarah as well. I think Elizabeth Shue's... I mean, it's easy to say it's her best work, but I think it's the best work that a lot of people were doing in the 90s. She is far beyond the standard of what was expected at that time for leading stars. Same for Nicolas Cage. It's, you know, it's rather clear to see why he was picked up for so much so long afterwards. It's the visualization of it. You can't escape that. It's kind of like the... It's the subtleties, it's the intricacies, it's the little bits and pieces that Figgis manages to adapt successfully. I think there's a real skill in that. And it's really unique. I don't think anybody else could have adapted it. It's very easy to just say, oh, nobody else could have done this. I really don't think anybody else but Nicolas Cage, Elizabeth Shue, and Mike Figgis could have adapted this.
I don't know where I'm leaning, honestly. Part of me wants to say the film because it's grown on me a lot, but I'll probably actually pick the book this time around. There is just something about the structure and the way it's written. It's very matter of fact, yet also it manages to sneak in a couple very deep poetic touches. But most of all, I'll probably say it's banal. It's a very banal reason. But you just spend more time with the characters. Though it's borderline, like scene for scene, beat for beat, it was like, oh my god, this is the whole book in a 2-hour movie. Because it's not even that long of a book. It's like 200-ish pages, maybe slightly less depending on the version you read. So it's not a long, doesn't take you too long to read. It's like a 5-hour read. So if you remove all of the internal monologues here and there and flashbacks, because for the most part they've been cut, only a couple have been left for Elizabeth Shue. It is incredibly faithful. One of the most faithful we've definitely discussed on this show.
Oh, definitely.
But I think I'll pick the book for this. I think I'll pick the book. Because it gave me, even though I prefer the ending of the movie, I think there's just something about the realness of the novel that just hit me in a way I was not expecting. Yeah. Still slightly missing from the film.
Yeah, I think it's regardless of the book or the film, though, there's a clear definition that Nicolas Cage's character, I mean, Ben Sanderson, he does not make excuses for his excess.
And
just to link it back to that Vegas, clearly nobody there is making excuses for how they behave or what they do.
No one judges
It's kind of a, it is genuinely like the what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas mentality. It is a free passage to do excess. You would not be able to do that much without batting an eyelid in any other part of the world. Yeah, maybe Sunderland.
this episode is promoted by the Sunderland Film Committee. Come visit us.
They don't have one.
Time to start one.
No.
But yes, definitely, if you've gotten this far in the conversation, do check out both the book and the film of Leaving Las Vegas. You've likely watched the movie, so definitely give the book a whirl. I think you won't be disappointed. This is it for this episode of the Death Adaptation Podcast. Ewan, rolling out the red carpet for you, where can our listeners find you? On the web.
Fold that red carpet back up. They can't find me anywhere. They can get me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Ewan Gledow, EWAN. For now, at the time of recording on the 7th of November, I am indeed blue ticked. But whether, I mean, I'm not going to pay £8 for it. That's just silly.
Have you gotten verified on Instagram? I noticed some people just kind of entered that area of kind of like,
I don't really use Instagram that much beyond posting pictures of me at gigs and me drunk. So I don't know if I'm allowed to get that verified. I might try though, just because I feel like I just wanted to go on record though that I got a blue tick before you could pay for them. So anybody that is like, oh, I'm verified on Twitter, yeah, but you weren't though, were you? I got it properly. I like not to go off on a tangent while I'm trying to plug my socials and stuff, but. I do find it quite funny that people are saying, oh yeah, but now everybody can have a blue tick. It's like, oh, I don't want one if anybody else can have one. People were saying, oh, it's a hierarchy thing. Yes, that was the point. That was to separate me from people like you. But anyway, give me a follow on Twitter and Letterboxd at Ewanglado, EwanGlado. And you can get my work on Cult Following, Newcastle World, Daily Star, Clapper, Don't Listen to This Podcast, which is where I talk about music and albums and all sorts of other lovely things, such as my hairline receding. By the time this episode goes out, I'll have played guitar on one of the episodes, so stick around for that. Because I can't play guitar, but I do own one, which is delightful. I'm also a voice on the podcast you're listening to right now, this very second, Death by Adaptation. And I'm sure I'll be back for... I don't actually know what the schedule's looking like, and I don't know what we've got next. I did start reading that book about that singer that we're going to talk about.
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that next month. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at NickyWara97 with links to everything on there, to my Linktree that has YouTube, Vimeo, Letterboxd, Clapper LTD. Like, if you like movies and cinema, give me a follow as well as the good you on here. And of course, check out the Death by Adaptation podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Death by Adaptation in the former, Death by Adaptation pod on the latter. Also, quick plug-in, check out the Uncut Gems podcast, as well as the Don't Listen to This pod, because they're a good time, and I've been there once for Ewan's podcast. There may be more episodes coming in the future, who knows?
So stay tuned for that. The recording schedule's caught up on me.
Yeah.
I'm behind.
Yeah, but as well on the Uncut Gems podcast, there's a lot of lovely discussions going there on at the moment. And I'm back as well, because schedule has moved around, and I can actually record things again on the evenings. Well, actually, speaking of the Uncut Gems podcast, in 2 weeks' time, Jakub Flash of the Uncut Gems podcast will be joining me to talk about We Can Remember It For You Wholesale by Philip K. Dick, which is better known as Total Recall, the film by Paul Verhoeven, and also a remake by Len Wiseman. We'll talk about that, but there's no, it's not the primary focus.
So. Do not slander that Bryan Cranston masterclass.
Oh.
I've not actually seen it. I just know Bryan Cranston's in it.
Oh, well, if you love Bryan Cranston, maybe skip that episode because he doesn't come away from it unscathed. That's all I'll say for now.
But still,
take it up with Jakub. But still, thank you very much for listening to this. We hope you have a great day, and we hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.